a Parkland father, a researcher, and a conversation about violent video games. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A recent video game was canceled due to controversy. It was a first-person shooter where the player could be a school shooter. We're going to hear from the father of a Parkland victim on this game and his response to gun violence in schools. Then, a psychologist who has worked on a study about violence in video games and its effects on kids. Plus, Tanzina Vega is the new host of The Takeaway and one of the few Latina hosts in the public media world. We'll hear from her about the changing face of news. And Lauren Groff's love-hate relationship with the Sunshine State.
For me, the word Florida conjures up a sense of just bone-deep dread covered over by sunshine.
Her new book is called Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas announced a nationwide tour yesterday titled March for Our Lives, Road to Change. The tour is centered around getting the vote out in key primary states and educating the public on gun control efforts. As that announcement was being made, Marjory Stoneman Douglas' father, Andrew Pollock, was with the Polk County Sheriff's Department as they embark on new Guardians program. The sheriff's office is training individuals to be armed guards on school campuses with the task of keeping schools secure from a future shooting. Now, Pollock is the founder of the nonprofit Americans for Children's Lives and School Safety, or Americans for Class. Pollock has been a voice on criticizing violence in the media, from the release of the videos of the Parkland shooter to a controversial video game that allowed the gamer to play the role of a school shooter. Mr. Pollock joins us now via Skype. Mr. Pollock, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So, first of all, help us understand this project that's going on in Polk County right now, this Guardian program. What is it?
Okay, it was about, the shooting took place February 14th, and there was a coach. His name was Aaron Feiss. Aaron heard shots and went charging into the building, unarmed. So Aaron went through the building to save lives, he was murdered that day on the 14th. And after that, there was a bill that I was part of getting passed, a safety bill, 7026, that we got passed up in Tallahassee. And a part of that bill is named after Aaron. It's called the Aaron Feiss Guardian Program. And in that bill, there was $67 million towards the training of armed guards in Florida. So the Sheriff Grady Judd is a great sheriff, had reached out to me a month after the bill got passed and had me come up to Polk County and meet with him and discuss the Aaron Feiss Guardian program that's in the bill. And I met with the school board where I spoke with all the school board members. And now it's 2 months later, they voted 7-0 in favor of arming veterans and retired law enforcement and vetted individuals into working at the schools. Where Broward County voted 9-0 not in favor, Polk County School Board voted 7-0 in favor of training these veterans and personnel to work at the schools. So yesterday, it was my honor to go up and speak in front of the first cadets that are going through the academy in Polk County, which is a great county that is.
So let me ask you this, is why do you believe these guardians will be more effective than the school resource officers or police that's responding to the scene?
Oh, it's just another layer. It's not that they're more effective. It's another layer at the schools. That Broward County, like at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, they have monitors, if anyone sees that. And I know Coral Springs has monitors. The monitor, Andrew Medina, was at the school that day at the gate, okay? He saw 1958 walk out of the car with a rifle bag and did nothing. He could have stopped everything at that moment and saved everybody's life. So what I'm getting at is it's a tiered system where multiple people you need for training to stop situations like that. So SROs, I'm not saying they're great, but you need a layers of security. And in Polk County, they're layering their security with guardians.
Okay. And those are school resource officers you just mentioned. You said 18-15-98. Is that what number did you give?
18-19-58. That's the criminal prison ID number of the shooter. And I think that after you saw the video of the shooter the other day, he did it for the fame. So it just shows that all the media out there, there's sociopaths in this world. It's just society now. There's individuals like that want to do it for the fame. So I recommend every media outlet out there never to show the shooter's face or use his name, and you'll see a difference with mass shootings in this country.
I wanted to come back to the fact that you're part of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. This is a commission put together by the governor. And there was a key part of that passage of additional funding for school safety measures paid for this. What have been the top priorities for the commission so far?
Well, right now, they're looking into response. We really only had one meeting so far. So the next meeting will be this week, so they're going to learn. There'll be a lot more information coming out. But I have my independent investigation that's going on, and I've been making a lot of progress with that at what's going on in the school system here in Broward that I'm going to let everybody know in Broward what's been happening.
And with this investigation, I mean, do you find you have access to, any of the information that regular investigators have? I mean, are you able to get into locations, talk to people the way law enforcement investigators are able to? I mean, what's your investigation about?
My investigation is going to be all the incompetency that led up to February 14th with allowing 18-19-58 into the school district. This whole promise program that the superintendent Runcie brought to Broward County, the leniency policy, the political correctness that's in Broward County, that's a cancer that led up to February 14th of non-reporting of criminals that go to the schools in Broward. Every kid should have a second chance, but to give kids five chances of misdemeanors per school year with no accountability, and then every year it starts from zero again. They could do more crimes. So in some of my research, we're talking with police officers and SROs, their hands are tied. Kids want to commit crimes at schools so they're not reported and they don't get arrested. That's what's going on in Broward.
My understanding is that you were at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas this morning. You were talking with campus administration about the school monitor on the scene during the shooting. How did that conversation go?
Oh, that went well because he won't be working there ever again. So that to have that, if anyone read that article on Andrew Medina, the guy has an IQ of maybe a three-year-old. If you read the article, not even a three-year-old. I'm saying he had the training. All the guy had to do was say code red. It's a code red when he even says it in the article. He calls him crazy boy. He sees him get out of the street, walking towards the building, doesn't call red or call the police, doesn't call code.
All right. You know what I wanted to ask you before we before we finish up,
I wanted to ask you about,
are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. You can hear me?
Yeah, okay. All right. I wanted to ask you before we finish up is
sure.
this story about this active shooter video game that you were in numerous stories and television interviews critical about this game. And again, this is a game that simulates the experience of being a school shooter on a campus. The game has since been dropped from the Steam platform and any future release is uncertain following the public outcry. But what message were you trying to convey about this game?
Well, they asked me a few people, but the game's distasteful. You know what I mean? I really think it was very distasteful on the manufacturer of this game. But to tell you the truth, there's thousands of video games with violence in it. So you really can't just focus on one video game. I really think that it's parenting. If you parent your kids right, you don't have to worry about them becoming a school shooter. So I don't believe in it, that game. You know, it's distasteful, but they're killing people in malls. They're killing people in buildings. you know, my kids play those games. My kid's not going to go out and commit a crime. So it's parenting. You know, parents need, most parents do the right job. That's my feeling on the game.
We've been talking with Andrew Pollack, father of Meadow Pollack, one of the 17 victims from the Parkland shooting. He's also the leader behind the nonprofit Americans for Class, which looks at making schools safer. Mr. Pollack, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks. Have a great day.
All right. And again, we were talking about that game, the active shooter. It raised this consistent question in the media whether or not violent video games can impact the psychology of players. Can they inspire violent behavior? Well, Dr. Sandra Calvert is the director of the Children's Digital Media Center and a child psychologist at Georgetown University. And she was part of a task force back in 2015 put on the American Psychological Association to explore the impact of violent video games on children's brains. And she joins us now. First of all, thank you so much, Dr. Calvert, for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So help us understand what current research tells us about the impact of violent video games on a child's brain. I mean, what's happening when a kid is playing a game like, say, Call of Duty?
We didn't actually look at how it affects the brain, because that's neuroscience, and that's not what's out in the literature. What we did is a review of the literature that exists, and we looked to see how it impacted children in a variety of ways. So there were two ways we did it. Once we looked at all the evidence that had come out recently when our task force had formed, and the other was we did what's called a meta-analysis, where you look at all the studies together that have different sorts of variables. But what we see in terms of our outcomes is that exposure to violent video games increased aggressive behavior, including things like hitting and pushing and fighting by kids' self-reports. It increased their arousal, so they got really pumped up. It increased their aggressive cognitions, that's thinking about things like hurting other people. It increased their aggressive feelings, and it increased how desensitized they were. So they stopped being real sensitive to how other people felt. It also decreased empathy, so they had less feelings for others. We did not have enough studies to really link violent video game use to delinquency or criminal behavior. So what our conclusion is overall is that exposure to violent video games is a risk factor. It's one of many risk factors for kids becoming aggressive, but it is one.
So when we hear these stories of school shootings, every now and then you'll hear someone try to make that link to the violent video games and how much those shooters played these games. But does anything in any research tell us that there's, you talk about a link to, certain behaviors, that it helps to enhance certain aggressive behaviors. But do we know any correlation between that and actually committing a crime?
In terms of correlational research, you know, there's not enough research. What you're looking for is a causal link. And when you're looking at these people who are shooters, there aren't that many of them. They're just a handful. So you would have to do basically a case study, you know, where you look at individual profiles. And, you know, many times these people kill themselves. So you can't really examine them that way. And like, the best way to do research is experiments, where you assign people to either play these games or not. And then you look at the outcomes for the people who play versus don't. But you can't do that in this case. It's not ethical. You would never want to expose kids intentionally to something that you think might cause them to become violent. So that's one of the problems. Now, with this particular game, the big issue with video games is how easily and readily do they transfer to real-life settings. And with the game that you were talking about, that was an active shooter game, that one of the things that happens is that the leap from what you're doing in the game to an actual real-life situation is pretty short. I mean, it's not that distant. So it's pretty close to, like, going through halls and shooting and killing people in this game that's in a high school and then going to an actual high school. So the problem is it's called a transfer issue, and it is one that is a real serious concern with something like this, where you're practicing, where kids actually go and practice things that they could then do that would harm others.
There have always been debates about violence in the media. Violent video games are just one form that adolescents are exposed to on a regular basis. But what about television and media? Are we playing a role at all in increasing aggression and aggressive behavior?
If you think about it, what you have is a whole world that's filled with a lot of violent content, and over time it desensitizes us to it. But one of the things that I have read for the people who have decided not to commit suicide after these attempts is that they want fame. And if you look at the news media, if you want a shortcut to fame or to be infamous, all you have to do is kill a lot of people, and then all of a sudden you're all over the headlines. So I'm really concerned, more so than even with the violent video games, I'm concerned about the traditional news media that gives these people a platform. And I don't think we should be talking about their names. I think we should be focusing on the victims and the harm to the victims and not on those people who are committing crimes, because it's giving them a platform and a lot of reinforcement for doing antisocial behaviors.
Now, we just heard from a father of a victim at Parkland who refuses to use the name of the Parkland shooter and actually calls this person by their prison number. Let me finish up with this. Is how should the media, the news media, approach these stories, you know, when it comes to child psychology? And again, this link between, possible link, but, you know, just, again, the research that's out there between violence and video games, violence and media, and, again, that's, you know, the effect on kids.
If you think about how we use our time, it shapes us. Boys are spending, adolescent boys, about an hour a day with games. And if you look at girls, they're spending maybe 7 minutes. And if you look at the time, you know, the time that we have in life, if you think that your time has no impact, what you're doing has no impact on who you become and what you do, I think that's not really taking a bigger picture at who we are. Certainly you could spend your time in better ways than killing people in simulated situations. So my own sense is to monitor. Most people, as this father said, would never go out and kill anybody else. But those few who do will have a huge impact on the rest of society. Our children deserve to have safe schools. Our kids are afraid to go to schools now. Their parents are afraid to send them. And if you look at this, one of the other big, big problems that we have is also access to guns. So it's not just one small thing. It's a whole society that has access to guns and kinds of things that media exposure, also parenting influences that can be negative, and antisocial qualities in kids like callous and unemotional traits, being poor. All these things work together to create these sorts of situations. But I would say for the news media that to use what this father is saying, and that is, do not put their pictures up there and do not give them any attention.
Dr. Sandra Calvert is the director of the Children's Digital Media Center and a child psychologist at Georgetown University. Again, looking at you know, the correlations, the impacts of violence and video games, how much time is spent playing them, and what that is doing to a child. Dr. Calvert, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Thank you. Bye.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet the new host of The Takeaway. You've been listening to her for a while, but now she's in the chair with me. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks so much again for joining us. Well, there's a new voice that's leading the public radio program, The Takeaway. Tenzina Vega was formerly a top journalist at the New York Times and CNN, reporting on race, inequality, and class in the United States. Focusing on inclusion and diversity in newsrooms has always been one of her key passions. In 2016, during her time at CNN, she created a 10-point plan called How Newsrooms Can Stop Being So White. The following year, she wrote an article for the Nieman Lab telling media companies it was time to pass the mic. Now, this week, The Takeaway is live from WLRN here in the studios in Miami, discussing many of the issues key to the listeners of South Florida, like climate change, gun violence, and, of course, our region's rich diversity. Tenzina Vega joins us now in studio. It's such a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know we were joking about who's hosting this segment, because it's a host and a host. So it's always don't feel like because I'm in this chair, it doesn't matter.
I do respect the chair. I have a deep respect for the chair, perhaps now more than ever, have to say, now that I've sat in it. So
Yeah, you know what? Because you spent time in the newspaper business and television, why did you want to be in radio? Why did you want to do this job?
First of all, who says no? to hosting their own show, which is a pretty huge opportunity. But really, I think all of the media that we're confronted with, Ishay, every day is overwhelming. And I think this was an opportunity for me to expand both professionally and expand to tell the types of stories and the type of reporting that I had already been doing at these other places. You mentioned The Times and CNN, and really take this out to a different audience, right? A broader, in many ways, broader audience. I think radio in particular is something that is so critical. I think back to Hurricane Maria, for example, when it hit Puerto Rico, one of the few things that was holding on, one of the few ways people in the more rural areas could communicate was via radio. And so it's still a critical tool for a lot of people. But you can also, you know, reach people on digital. You can reach people in different ways. It just, to me, it was an area. And by the way, I was an intern at WNYC a very, very long time ago. So I had a taste of it. I just didn't have the host chair.
I gotcha. Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't totally alien to you, but, you know, when you think about you've worked in the other mediums, you know, you worked in print, you worked in television, and this is so different. I mean, but was that transition difficult at all for you?
Or? So I think in some ways, the connecting thread in all the media that I've done has been digital, right? So even when I was at The Times, I was writing, but I was still doing audio podcasts. I was still doing videos. And when I went to CNN, I added on, you know, what it felt like to do live television. But still, the main focus was digital. So working in multimedia platforms and working with audio in its purest form and going out and recording and getting video and putting that together with still photography and the written word is sort of my comfort zone, right? It's how I was raised as a journalist in many ways. And so to me, what struck me about the job is really the intensity of what it means to be a host, the pace of the show, right? The production of how this comes together. And I am still in awe of the work that we are able to do and the speed with which we are able to do it. I said to, you know, one of my producers, I said, yeah, it's almost like you're putting together a mini New York Times in an hour, you know, and that's a stunning feat. And for those of you who've never seen how radio gets put together, I highly recommend checking it out.
Yeah, please don't think that I just sit down and start talking, that people like Tintin and I do.
Yeah,
that.
No. There is a whole team of people here who are making this work.
My producers make me look very good. You came in at a very unique time because so much was going on because of the Me Too movement, but specifically in the media and specifically public media.
That's right.
So much was changing. And your show was really almost at the center of it all because of the previous host and everything that he was accused of. I mean, first, let's just start with this. When you came in and you know you're following that sort of story, what's your approach? Do you want to ever try to tackle that problem or get as far away from it? I mean, you're coming in and taking over. What was your opinion of that?
I think, and you mentioned this just now, I've been working on issues of inclusion and diversity in newsrooms almost by default, right, since I started in this business. And it's become much more of a formal thing for me as the years have gone on. You noted some of the pieces that I've written about this issue. I've tweeted extensively about it, but I've also written a lot about it. So I'm very conscious of it. I'm a woman. I'm a woman of color. I'm a woman that, you know, came from a low socioeconomic background. I grew up in public housing. So all of these things are things that don't necessarily fit the profile already of who we think of when we think of public radio hosts, when we think of top columnists, right? We don't think of that. And so I'm already sort of an anomaly in this space in many ways. And I've taken that as both an opportunity and it's a challenge. To me, the opportunity, both at WNYC, has been to finally, what I think is happening in the industry is a course correction. And unfortunately, the course correction is coming at the expense of or is coming at a time when it's following some pretty horrific things that have happened to people in media, right? And it's not limited to public media. I mean, we saw this at the New York Times. We've seen this at other news outlets. We've seen it in the boardroom. We've seen it, you know, in Hollywood. So I think what we're seeing now is it's sad that it has to take such a terrible thing to happen for change to occur. That said, change is happening. And I think the industry is recognizing that it has to course correct, not just because we need to fill the chair with it's someone who checks a bunch of boxes, right? And I think that's where we get off track by thinking, okay, now we're going to, you know, solve this problem by getting someone who checks off, you know, the diversity box or the inclusion box or the woman box or whatever boxes. We're getting people who are qualified for these positions into the jobs that they're deserving
of. Yeah, but how should managers go forward? How should they be looking at this when you had really almost like this group of white males, number of hosts all of a sudden gone, and you're thinking about replacing them. And that's the conversation right now is like, well, there is no inclusion and there isn't there's no diversity. So the reaction is going to be, well, then let's go find that diversity.
Right. Right. And I do often say the last thing you want to say to somebody is we're reaching out to you because we want to become more diverse. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's an unfortunate way to approach inclusion. I think it's really incumbent on organizations. You know, I think about this all the time. You think about Silicon Valley, right? We're able to solve problems that are beyond, you know, that we didn't even know we had. Right. And we're creating technology to do things that we didn't even know we wanted to do. And yet we sit here and say we can't find qualified people of color. That just doesn't jibe for me. That seems to be more about resistance than it is about actual change. If you can create an iPhone, you can figure out how to find qualified and diverse and inclusive people to bring into your organization. So a lot of it just feels like an excuse, quite frankly.
We are talking with Tansina Vega. She is the new host of The Takeaway, took over that position not that long ago. And they are here at the WLRN studios in Miami for this week, doing their program from here, covering a lot of the issues that you hear all the time, because they're talking about the issues that are important to folks here in South Florida, like climate change and so forth. You know what? Sticking with what you said, though, is I wonder if you don't have managers in news and they talk about diversity, but they're also thinking about their audiences. Are the audiences diverse enough? Does it matter? Because I've always heard that the saying, like, well, I got to find somebody who looks and sounds like my audience.
Right.
So does that mean that the audience is just a white male?
No, I think that's the excuse. Again, I think that it's a question of, you know, if we do that, it's almost the same thing that we say about culture fit, right? I want to hire people that I understand. It's a comfort zone. People feel comfortable there. I don't think what I'm saying in my show is anything that's not newsworthy or anything that people who aren't, you know, we're trying to cover things across the country. So we're here in Miami. We're talking to Floridians about the issues that are important to them. So that's irrespective of whether or not I'm a woman or a person of color, right? I think that's news. That's journalism. I think often too long, these are excuses that we've used or that organizations and not just media have used to limit the representation that they have.
So when you take over this program, does something change? And obviously, you bring your own personality.
I was going to say,
you're different. No, but I mean, like, is there something that changes in the way you approach the programming? Because, yeah, you are a different host, but...
Yes. So journalistically, to me, the most important thing, I think, you know, having worked in at the New York Times, having worked in cable news, CNN, all the big outlets here, I think particularly now we're assaulted with media on a daily basis. There are a million podcasts you could listen to right now. You have your choice of, you know, Twitter feeds to follow, et cetera, et cetera. To me, I feel that we are getting lost in an avalanche of news. And what we need to do is take a step back and say, okay, what's really happening here? At the same time, I think people are a little bit tired of always hearing from only experts. And they really want a combination of how does this affect me? Right on the ground in Miami. How does this affect me in New York? Let's hear from people who are really going through this so that we really can have an American conversation. And I think part of my goal was to say, you know what? There are conversations happening here in Miami that aren't happening in San Jose, for example. There are conversations that are happening in San Jose that aren't happening in Omaha and vice versa. And we can go around the country. And that's part of the problem, right? And so hopefully what we're trying to do is bring these different voices to the table so that we can share information. Americans are very segregated country. We don't like to admit that. We don't engage often with each other on an interpersonal level. And I think that's part of the division that you're seeing now. So what we're trying to do journalistically is open up this conversation to others. What this also offers, I mean, you know, me being in the chair, I am a lot very receptive to certain types of stories that I think don't get told. One of the biggest stories that I think often does not get told is one of class and one of real economic inequality. And we talk about racial inequality, and that's a critical thing, but we also need to understand the numbers behind it. So I'm trying to bring more real voices to the table. I'm trying to bring a lot more data to the table, things that can help us frame contextually what we're going through as a country.
When you brought this up at CNN, what was the response?
The response to?
When you brought up and you said to them, it's like, hey, listen, here's this 10-point plan on, you know, how to keep newsrooms from being so white.
They loved it. So here's what happened. So that happened organically. That was the second article that I wrote. There were two pieces that I wrote. The first happened, both of them were spawned on Twitter. They started with my reactions to the numbers. American Society of News Editors often comes out with these numbers. I think it's yearly or every other year, where they describe how many people, you know, of color are in different newsrooms around the country. And those numbers have not changed. And so when I first started at CNN, I did this tweet storm that generated a conversation among editors across all platforms, Mother Jones, New York Times, you know, you name it, and started that piece. After that, we're talking almost 2 years later, there was another conversation. At this point, I'm thinking, this is crazy. We're still talking about how to change this. But we're talking around it, right? We're not talking directly at the issue. What is it that people can actually do? And so that was a conversation I had with my editor. And she says, you know, you got to do this. We got to write this. So they were 100% behind putting this out there.
Where did this passion come from?
The passion came from my lived experience, I think, you know, a lot. And also just because it's not just about me. Again, when you look at the numbers, you look at the ASNI numbers, you see the stalling, you say, wait a minute, our country is becoming browner, okay, but our newsrooms are not. The rest of our, you know, we haven't even seen a lot of that change at the, you know, at the federal level. We've had one black president in this entire, and no women, you know. So here we are in 2018, and we're still dealing with these issues.
So as you're coming up, you know, in the business, I mean, who are your role models? Who did you look up to?
I came up in the business when, well, I mean, I, to be honest with you, I watched a lot of television when I was a kid, a lot of when people used to actually have to be home to watch the news. Do you remember those days when the news only came on at 5 and at 6?
I'm a Gen Xer, I know.
So am I. Thank you. I feel so good that you said that. I'm not alone. No one cares about us. You do realize that. So for those Gen Xers out there who remember watching the nightly news when you had to be there, growing up watching my parents read the paper, there was sort of journalism was always around me. And I didn't ever really expect to end up at places like the New York Times. And even when you end up at a place like the New York Times, and I started as a clerk, you know, it wasn't like a big sexy job. I was a clerk. And I didn't expect to, you know, do much more. And they'll tell you, clerks don't write for the paper and, you know, you're never going to get anywhere. But, you know, you do the job, you keep saying yes, and sometimes things work out.
As we finish up, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you're from Florida.
No, I'm from New York.
You're from New York. Mm-hmm. You grew up in, no, you lived in Florida at any point?
No.
No. Okay. No. That's my mistake.
I like Florida.
Okay. Well, no. I mean, how many times have you been down here?
A couple times. I guess my first time was when I was, can't even remember, actually. My dad lives in Florida. That's probably what you're thinking.
I see. Okay, yeah. I gotcha. But I mean, I wanted to get your impression of Florida and the time that you've spent here so far. I know it's not a lot, but you know, I love hearing from people about their thoughts on the state of Florida because, you know, Florida gets
a lot of attention, not always good attention, should I say. But it's often at the butt of a lot of jokes, unfortunately. But I do think
we're used to it.
Yes. But the work that we're doing here actually this week is really important. We are looking at climate change. And we've been looking at not just the sea level rise, but also the business around that. What's happening? What are the insurance companies saying about this? What's the business community doing about this? What is the real impact that climate change is going to have on this state? And one of the things I think people don't often connect is that climate change is directly impacting gentrification, right? Which is something that we're here reporting on. We're in Little Haiti and we're in different communities talking to people about what that feels like, right? But we're also talking to children about gun violence, right? And not just the students who had to suffer that tragedy in Parkland, but also students, largely Black students, low-income students who are dealing with gun violence every day. So I think, you know, we can joke about a lot of these issues, but Florida is also a critical state politically, and it's a critical state for a lot of people, and there are a lot of communities here, and there are tons of stories that have to be told.
Tantina Vega, again, the new host of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is here at WLRN Studios all week this week, covering all these stories that she's just mentioned. Tantina, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk with author Lauren Groffer about her new book, Florida, speaking of Florida. That's coming up next here on WLRN Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Author Lauren Groff is like many of us who call Florida home. She has a love-hate relationship with it, and it comes through in her collection of short stories in the new book titled Florida. Groff is the author of bestsellers like Arcadia and Fates and Furies. She's a National Book Award finalist, and she's going to be at Books and Books in Coral Gables tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Now, she joined us recently from the studios of WUFT in Gainesville, where she calls home, and we started by asking her, what was the first time she stepped foot in the Sunshine State?
Well, my husband is from Gainesville, Florida, and when I first met him, I thought, oh, that's strange. I will never visit Florida. But within about 2 months of dating him, we came down here for Thanksgiving, and I was bewitched and made strange by all this the weird nature down here.
Yeah, tell me about that experience. I mean, you know, people who first step foot in the Sunshine State, there's a lot going on. And I'm wondering about those first sensations and emotions that come across for you when you first saw this place.
So I'm from upstate New York in this little tiny village called Cooperstown, which is where the Baseball Hall of Fame is. And it's got this beautiful, lush lake and these rolling hills. And so just in terms of just atmosphere and geography, Florida couldn't be any more different. In particular, Central Florida, which is very swampy and full of mangroves and, you know, strange wildlife. And so I truly did not know what to do with myself here. I was afraid of everything. Everything felt very dangerous to me, from the insects, the palmetto bugs, which are 3-inch, you know, cockroaches, basically, that fly at your face, to the palmettos themselves, which are sharp and sort of catch at your ankles as you're walking through the woods, to, of course, the first time I saw Spanish moss, I put it on my head, which is the rookie mistake, and, you know, I got chiggers, as one does. So it has been a very steep learning curve, for sure.
Now, you live in Gainesville, Florida. That's a college town. And that's that part of Florida that you don't have tons of gated communities and these tall condos lining the waterfront. But tell me about the inspiration that you find there.
For the first 5 years I lived in Gainesville, I actually would have been hard-pressed to find anything that I liked about it, primarily just because it wasn't what I thought that I was meant to be living. It's very hot in Florida, especially Central Florida, because we don't have the ocean breeze. And it's just, it's kind of an alien place. But slowly over time, I have learned to really appreciate the nature. I mean, we are in this just bursting fecundity here. We've got just more trees in Gainesville than we have people. And the art scene is lively. It's really cheap here. You know, I mean, we have a lot of artists and punks and people who write, and it's a very vibrant and unusual place. I really love Gainesville now after 12 years.
I wanted to know, what role did you want the state to play in this collection of stories for your new book, Florida?
Well, for Florida, for me, is a very specific thing. It's the state itself is so vast, and it's kind of a monkey bread. You see as a piece of it, but there's so many other stories to be told. I mean, I don't think any human being could write the history or the story of Florida. It's just impossible. It's a narrative that's constantly shifting. A lot of layers are happening all at once. But for me, the word Florida conjures up a sense of just bone-deep dread covered over by sunshine, which is how I experience the state. And I have a great deal of just passionate love for Florida, but also equal and opposite dislike. And I feel suspended between those two incredibly strong emotions. I'm like a spider on a web. I'm just sort of held up in the air between my love of this place and my visceral dislike.
You know, listening to you just now, and you talk about that beauty, but there's a loneliness that I kind of got through. And I get it through the stories. I mean, there's a story of a woman who takes these long walks while her family's back at home. You have the two sisters living in this abandoned remote cabin out in the backwoods. You got a young boy who's abandoned by his mother. Then he loses his father. He grows up in this house that he was born in. I mean, does Florida just lead us into this sense of loneliness? Is it the perfect setting for loneliness?
It is for me, just in my own experience. I think Florida is, as I said, just teeming with narratives. And I think someone could write the exact opposite book to mine. But my Florida is a very lonely Florida. I came here not knowing anyone. I'm a writer, so I spent all of my days inside the house alone. So it is a very isolated experience. And without my family, I wouldn't most days talk to other human beings. And I think that's reflected in the stories also. But I do think, you know, it's an existential thing, right? And a lot of the stories in the book are pushing toward this understanding of ourselves and trying really hard to connect with other people. I mean, I think that's the reason why most writers of literary fiction write. It's just to find another soul in the world to whom you can speak, right? And it's difficult. And I think the reason why we go to writing is because we have a hard time doing that in our actual lives. Not to get too down, but, you know, writing is a lonely occupation. You have to sort of love the loneliness and the solitude and the isolation.
Can you imagine yourself anywhere else now? I mean, you spend more than a decade in Florida.
I can absolutely imagine myself everywhere else in the world. But that said, while I would not have chosen to live in Florida, and some days I even wake up fighting it, I am so grateful that it chose me. I am so deeply moved by the state on a daily basis and the people in it and the nature. I mean, we just went to the Sewanee, to this nutty place where kids sort of swung out over the river on these long rope swings. And I was just watching and I was thinking, nowhere else on the planet would you see something so strange and beautiful and collectively performative. It was just a very strange moment of being both alienated and deeply within the nature and the humanity and the way that they interacted here.
I've heard from different writers throughout my life that, you know, they have a different take when it comes to writing short stories. Some of them are intimidated or they're uninterested because they want that room to draw out their characters and their story. But I wonder how you approach your narrative and your character development in such a short space.
My experience in writing novels and short stories is that novels and short stories are very, very different. I mean, short stories are much more like poetry, and I began writing as a poet, but I'm a profoundly failed poet, so I turned to fiction. But for novels, you know, you wake up with this thing. It's like being in a long marriage, you know, you wake up with this thing. Some days you don't like it, but you always love it, and you have to put in the work. But short stories for me are these ideas that I have that sort of circulate in my subconscious like fish for sometimes up to 12 years. One of these stories here took 12 years to write. And I will try to write it, and then put it back into the subconscious to be embroidered upon until something happens. I read a book, or I see something, or I talk to someone, or something sparks that story so that it falls down in front of me and I can't actually see the novel I'm always working on. And then I write the story. So a novel is a long, slow, beautiful, you know, act of faith. A short story is an act of ecstatic imagination.
You mentioned in a previous interview that when you approach creating a book, it's like, quote, a 3D printer city of stories that you can shape and mold. Flesh that idea out for us. Explain what, you know, how that applies in short stories.
So, well, my process is very strange, and I have taught before, and I've told students not to do this unless they truly, truly want to try it. But what I do is I write many drafts, and I write a quick few first drafts of the same thing, throw them out in between, and start over again. And I write everything longhand at that time, too, because I actually don't want to be wedded to the work that I'm producing, and I can't read my handwriting. So you throw it out in between, and what happens is, after about 4, 5, 6, 7 drafts, you have built a world, and you've built sort of a narrative that you know the insides and outsides of, and you can choose your way through that world and figure out, hold it in your hands like a 3D printed piece, a sculpture, or a house, a dollhouse in your hands, and pick your way through it. And I find that a very enriching and beautiful way to write, but I usually use that to write novels. Short stories are a little different in that I really do want to do the whole thing in one sitting. So even though they usually don't succeed for the first 5 or 6 drafts, there's a lot of time between those drafts. I'm not, you know, throwing it out and starting over immediately and writing it from a different point of view or from a different place and time or changing the gender of the narrator, etc. What I'm doing in short stories is revisioning the entire project and in trying to find a better way to get at this platonic ideal that I have sort of hovering over my head.
And you handwrite your stories?
I handwrite everything, yes, which is astonishing because my handwriting is worse than my 7-year-old's. It's really bad.
I don't hear a lot of people still handwriting.
Oh, no. Well, so writing for me is not just an intellectual exercise. I mean, it's a pure full body thing. And I think that getting your body as deeply into the page as possible is really important, especially considering the page itself has pores in it, like skin. I mean, you have to actually feel as though you're really committing to this thing. And one thing that I do is really commit by doing everything by hand, actually feeling the pain in my hand, not pushing the computer away, which is what I do at the very, very end after I've gotten a draft I'm actually happy with, but actually spending the time forming the words on the page that I then cross out. And it's fluid. It's more fluid. And, you know, on a computer, it just feels very concrete. It looks like print.
So I've read that you are a voracious reader, and I'm wondering, who, in your opinion, are the best Florida writers, people who really, they capture the essence of life in this state?
Oh, there's so many good writers from Florida. It's pretty wonderful. I think Peter Matheson's Shadow Country is one of the strongest, most beautiful books, period, but also about Florida. Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, she's my old favorite. Just yesterday, I drove by her house out in Cross Creek, and she breaks my heart a little bit because The Yearling, which is her best book, has been categorized as a children's book, and I want adults to read it because it tells you so much about this incredible state. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, of course, she's pioneer. I mean, absolutely amazing. Let me think. There's so many. I think current day, there are so many beautiful young writers. Kristen Arnett is really great. Laura Vandenberg, Karen Russell. The state is full of talent and strangeness. And I love that there are so many great writers who are just trying to seize it now.
If you continue to tackle stories about life in Florida or from Florida, I'm just curious as to what other elements about life here do you want to approach that you didn't get to in this book?
I'm actually not sure, because I think that particularly short stories come out of whatever you're living at the moment, and the way that it's translated through the story that's been building in your head for as long as you've had it. So I will have to live a little bit more to tell you the answer to that question. I'm not sure.
Well, we'll be happy to have you back when you do. So,
well, thank you.
Again, we've been talking with Lauren Groff. Her new book is called Florida. It's a collection of short stories. A lot of them, most of them in some way, take place here in Florida, or it's about life in Florida, the characters that we all know so well, the kind of people you run into only in the Sunshine State. By the way, she's going to be at Books and Books Wednesday, June 6th at 8 p.m. She's joining us from the studios of WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. Lauren, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
It was so wonderful. Thank you so much.
I also want to mention, too, that later today we're going to post up, she actually read an excerpt from her book, and so we'll post that up on Facebook and Twitter. Just look up WLRN Sundial. We'll get that up there as quickly as we can. And as I mentioned, tomorrow she'll be at Books of Books in Coral Gables. Well, that's the program for today, this Tuesday, June 5th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, find us on iTunes, WLRN Sundial, or go online, WLRN.org. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great one.